This is Ralph Metzner, March 7th, 2014. The talk is entitled C.G. Jung, Albert Hofmann, and the Philosopher's Stone. This talk was accompanied by a slideshow, and the slideshow was on the DVD in the library of the Seattle Jung Society. This is part one of two.
Thank you, Kathy, for that generous introduction. Can you hear me okay like this? This works? Yes, the video of the line dance, well, that was kind of an accident. Not an accident, but unexpected. It was at the conference honoring Albert Hofmann's 100th birthday, which was a conference in Basel, Switzerland, in 2004, attended by about 3,000 people. So the organizers asked me. They had all the speakers, including Albert Hofmann, up on the stage, and he was like 100 years old. But he's a very upright and very strong voice, not at all frail. He did have a cane to walk, to help him walk, but he did it too. He did the, it's, some of you may be familiar with this South American ayahuasca church called the Santo Daime. They take ayahuasca and they dance, it's a church, you know, it's like gospel, like singing, it's very rhythmic kind of celebrating, honoring the divine. It's not like a journey where they go inside. They sing and dance songs and like hymns, but like gospel. And they do two steps to the left and two steps to the right. It's very simple, kind of back and forth like that. So I have a recording of songs. And anyway, they used one of my recordings translated it spontaneously into Santo Daime dance, and then got 2,000 people to get up and do it. It was great. It worked out well. See, because they had movable chairs. You couldn't do it in an auditorium where the seats are fixed. But I've since started doing that sometimes in lectures, and people usually appreciate it, you know, because you're sitting in a lecture, especially at the conference, you're sitting for hour after hour after hour, and then you have a coffee break and talk with other people. But people really appreciated that they could kind of engage with some of the ideas and images and symbols while moving in a very simple way. So that was the story behind that little story. So my title, I want to talk to you because you're the Jung Institute and connected to Carl Jung, and it's an interesting thing. I was very influenced by Jung. I wouldn't describe myself as a Jungian, per se, in a strict sense. Jung himself actually once said, I am not a Jungian, and I don't want to be one. Because he was uncomfortable about having followers, you know, who described themselves as a Jungian. Unlike Freud, he was the opposite. He liked to have, and he had very strict rules about who could call himself a Freudian, and it was constantly throwing people out who, you know, distancing himself from people that didn't agree with his theories, like Wilhelm Reich and Carl Jung. Jung was not a Freudian. That was the big story between them. And so was Wilhelm Reich. Nevertheless, I have a very, very high regard for Carl Jung as a psychologist and psychotherapist, and my work is very influenced by him, and my practice is very, very influenced by him, as well as by other people, as well as by Freud. And in that sense, I follow, as a therapist, the lead of my very close friend, Stanislav Grof, who's a Czech psychiatrist, who was also familiar with psychedelic drugs, as I was and am, and felt that he also integrated, took the best of Freud's idea and Jung's idea, because Jung broadened the Freudian insights of mechanism defense and the unconscious and all of those kind of things, primitive impulses and defenses against them, and broadened them. Jung broadened them out into the collective. That was one of his big expansions, into the collective, so that there could be these archetypal ideas that underlie whole groups of people or even all of humanity. So So the idea that they share, and Groff shares and I share, is that the so-called unconscious, which I actually, they don't use the term the unconscious anymore because it's what linguists would call a reification. It makes it sound as if there is such a thing as an unconscious something or a place. The unconscious doesn't actually exist. You know, we have certain thoughts, and some of the thoughts are sometimes unconscious. And certain feelings and impulses and so forth are unconscious, and some of them are sort of semi-conscious, and some of them are more conscious and intentional. And we can talk about that. So as an adjective, that's one thing. But to talk about the unconscious makes it sound like it's a place, and it's not a place. It's usually in books that they read about it, it's set up in layers. You know, well, you've got the unconscious here, and then you know, you've got the conscious, and then the unconscious, and in between you have the preconscious, and then you have other layers. Other writers will write, well, you have the unconscious, the conscious, the preconscious, the personal unconscious, and then the collective unconscious. And then some of the Neo-Jungians, you probably know this, actually made a distinction in the collective unconscious and said, well, there's the collective unconscious, the archetypes, that's shared by all humanity, all human beings. But between the personal unconscious and the collective unconscious, there's a cultural unconscious that's shared by some human beings, the ones belonging to a certain group of people, for example, Jewish people, or Christian people, or Buddhist people, or Asian people. So it's kind of collective more than the individual, sort of primordial images. And some of the later Jungians acknowledge that. And I actually think, and I've written in some of my books, that even the idea of the collective unconscious needs to be expanded. And because that's because of my studies in ecology and you know, the wider planetary world in which we live. Because the collective unconscious is the level of human beings, all human beings. So beyond that, or below that, if you like, it's not really actually below anywhere, but beyond that is the consciousness layer that is shared among all animals. And human beings are animal species, so all species of animals have a kind of consciousness. We know that now. Animals are not unconscious. And they're not dealing with archetypes the way we understand archetypes. So what is it? It's some other kind of layer, some other kind of consciousness. You could go all animals, and then you could have another layer that could be all life, all organic life. You know, that would include plants and mushrooms and fungi and plants. You know. And then you could have another layer, and ecologists, in fact, do talk about that. We call it the entire planet. It's called Gaia consciousness. You know, and people like James Lovelock and well, of course, it makes sense that animals and plants are sentient beings. Why wouldn't the planet itself be a sentient being? What kind of a sense would that be? Of course the planet is a sentient being. It's not like human consciousness, but it includes, you know, human consciousness, just like our body consciousness, it includes cells, cellular consciousness. And so you could talk about Earth, planet, planetary consciousness, include all Earth. But why stop there? What's the next system? See, this is systems thinking. The next, and systems are inclusive, systems within systems. And then each system at each level is itself part of a larger system that function together interdependently. So the whole Earth, planet, Gaia consciousness is part of the solar system. So solar system consciousness, that plays a big role in traditional societies. The idea of a solar deity, somehow, and all the planets in the solar system have the names of deities. So the Greeks obviously thought, and the Romans, the ancient people obviously thought, planets were alive and they gave them the names of gods and goddesses. Or somebody gave them those names, or human beings did, of course. Human beings go around naming things. Other species don't do naming things. Have you ever had that experience? You go out for a walk and I used to have that. I go out for a walk in the woods and I'm trying to test myself. Do I know the name of that plant? And do I know the name of the plant? And no, I don't know that one. I wish I would know that one, but I wish I knew more. And then I suddenly realized, it was kind of like a message or something, a realization. The plants and the trees don't care whether I know their names or not, or whether anybody gives them their names or not. Not at all. It has nothing to do with their essence. They're not aware of it. It doesn't matter to them. They lead their life just fine, whether or not we name them. That was really interesting. It was a big relief. I didn't have to go around worrying about it. I don't know the name of this plant, nor do I know how it does all the things that it does, you see. I don't have any idea of how the plant, how the tree manages to draw the sap up and how the cells do all their biochemistry. How much of us do we know? And yet, of course, we know, the scientists know, and they have their language to describing it. So consciousness exists at many levels. So I was saying the solar system, but then, of course, if you go that, expand that system, the solar system is part of the galaxy, 200 other million solar systems, 200 other million solar systems, which are themselves rotating in a gigantic disk over hundreds of millions of years, which are themselves, and there are hundreds of billions of galaxies in a galactic cluster, and there's hundreds of millions, uncounted clusters of galaxies in the universe. It doesn't stop, you see. When people talk about cosmic consciousness, universal consciousness. And then we are back to human beings. You could always expand through the different levels of the system. You could also go down the other direction. You could talk about the individual human being. You could talk about the organs in the body. So there's a heart consciousness, a liver consciousness, a muscle consciousness, a bone consciousness. Of course there is. And we become aware of it mostly when there's a pain or a disease. Or if we're practicing yoga, then they tell you to focus on your breath and become aware of your breath, and then maybe you become aware of your digestive system. You become conscious of these normally ongoing unconscious processes. And then you can go on down, and this is true in psychedelic experiences, happens where you can get down to the level of cellular consciousness. And people take ayahuasca and, you know, they tune into cellular processes. There's a Swiss scientist who's gone to taken biochemists and neurophysiologists to the Amazon and given them ayahuasca and tried to get them to describe their experiences in terms of the language of biochemistry that they know. So they were able to describe their experiences and have the vision that was relevant to their work. And they didn't, you know, use like the native people use images of serpents and, you know, that kind of thing. They use their languages. They could say, oh yeah, I can tune out. Jeremy Narby is a Swiss scientist whose argument is that his name, the name of his book is, I forget at the moment. Anyway, his thesis is that he's taken the descriptions of the ayahuasca visions of the shamans in the Amazon and compared that to the statements of the biochemists and neuropysiologists and geneticists. That are describing the processes at the cellular and molecular level and saying they're the same thing. They're describing the same thing and the language of their tradition, of course. So the idea of the expansion of consciousness, I like that concept. No, that was actually a term that Leary came up with, my old colleague at Harvard, to describe the effects of the drugs that later on were described as psychedelic. And I actually, and it was interesting, I only recently came across some correspondence between Leary and Albert Hoffman. You know, I was very close to Hoffman in his later years, but at the time, at the Harvard Project, we also corresponded with him. And he really liked this was before the term psychedelic was kind of agreed upon for these substances like psilocybin and LSD that we were exploring. And Hoffman said he liked the idea of consciousness expanding, but ultimately people came to use psychedelic, which is a kind of a made-up term suggested by Aldous Huxley, which means kind of something like mind manifesting. And the reason I now have started to, in the last few years, started to go back to using consciousness expanding is because psychedelic has in the meantime, and this is interesting from the point of view of cultural history. See, psychedelics now have accrued a whole cultural history. In fact, a really terrible cultural reputation, actually. First of all, they're illegal, and there's all kinds of imagery about danger and madness and crazy and people doing wild, crazy things, going crazy, being illegal, being in jail, going to jail because they should, all of that. That was all nothing, nothing. That was nothing. You could have had LSD, XYZ, IBM, just three neutral letters, meant nothing. It's impossible to think back to that era, see? You could never do that now. So, and psychedelic has accrued other meanings. It's got accrued sort of meanings of paisley patterns. In fact, my daughter, when she was like 9 years old, came back one day from school and said, "Hey, look at those colors, psychedelic, woo, woo." She had no idea what the origin of that term was. It's paisley patterns. Well, I don't know if you've ever experienced LSD or psilocybin, but paisley patterns is not the essential feature of an LSD experience. Please, if it was, why would there be this whole this here about it? It's one way of representing some of the visuals. You see, it has nothing of the core. So anyway, in order to get back to, and I like the consciousness expanding, because consciousness is itself a very mysterious kind of concept or term. It has so many different meanings, at least three different essential meanings, which I'm not going to go into now, but maybe we'll have time. But for one thing, so people, it's kind of an abstraction. So when you say consciousness expanding, many people think, maybe you taught this yourself, consciousness can expand. Well, who knew? Who knew that it's the kind of thing that can expand? What does that mean? See, it's two ordinary words. So, actually, consciousness can expand, and it can also contract. And it expands every morning when you wake up. And it contracts every evening when you fall asleep. When you wake up, you know, you may be having a dream, or you may be sort of unconscious in a sleep state, and then you start to open your eyes, you become aware of your body. You're in this body, you're in this bed, you're next to your partner, and then this is my room, here's my dog, my cat, my garden, my house, my job, my family, my society. A series of consciousness expandings happens every morning when you wake up. It's like taking off the blinders of sleep. In the sleep, you might have been living another life, another whole scene. And when you go to sleep at night, you contract, you know, you withdraw. But now consciousness expanding means you become aware of more. So, for example, you can intentionally, your consciousness, when you go for a walk in the woods, whether alone or with somebody else, you're taking a walk, you're not focusing on anything. You're just walking around. And you're hearing the birds and the bees and watching seeing the trees and the clouds and the sky. It's a kind of a romantic, no particular purpose, just to enjoy the scenery like that. Now, on the other hand, let's say you have to perform a piano concerto, or you have to go for a job interview, or you have to operate a heavy piece of machinery like a car. You don't want to be expanding your consciousness. You want to be concentrating, which is a narrowing of consciousness. I mean, each one of you, and I'm concentrating actually right now on all of you, and I'm concentrating on the thoughts that I'm, you know, verbalizing, and I'm concentrating on each one of you, and you're giving me the gift of your attention. In German, you say "Schenk die Aufmerksamkeit," which means the gift of attention. In English, you say "pay attention." It's kind of interesting cultural difference between the German and the English, I don't know. But in both cases, it means it's something that you give, that you do. It's not just passively taking in, you see. If you were just passively taking in, it's like being at the movies or something. It's not like that. And we got together because for which I thank you for this purpose. Now, but our consciousness could expand. For example, if there was a loud sound, an explosion, then we would like all go, what was that outside? Or if a naked man or a naked woman walked in the door, we would like lose the focus on my talk, and you would think, what is happening here? There's some other story happening, you see. So consciousness can expand and contract all the time. If it contracts intentionally, or it contracts or expands intentionally with according to our intentions, or it can also contract and expand accidentally when our attention is fixated. And when attention and consciousness is repetitively fixated, we call that compulsion and addiction. It's the difference between, you know, an alcoholic drinking beer after beer after beer versus, you know, normally you or I just drinking a beer occasionally, or wine or whatever like that. The difference is not in the drug. It's in the way that our consciousness, we let our consciousness be altered by the drug according to our intention, whether we're thinking, doing it with intention and awareness and under our control, under our intention, or whether we're being pulled into an addictive, repetitive, compulsive pattern. Compulsions, addictions, obsessions are all in that fixated contractions of consciousness. If you've ever seen the film that was made by Richard Pryor, the comedian, where he described the progression of his addiction to cocaine, it's an awesome performance. I recommend that you get a copy of it, because he describes how he, you know, increasingly got rid of his friends, told his friends to go away, his friends kept saying, didn't want to do anything, just the pipe, crack cocaine, you know, just several times a day, just go away, nothing matters, friends come, no, nothing matters. Increasingly, just go away. Just leave me. You know, just like his whole world shrank more and more. I think we can all see in ourselves, or perhaps in people that you know, similar kinds of pattern with addictive drugs or compulsive behaviors. It doesn't necessarily have to be a drug. It can be a compulsive behavior. So the general idea of expansions and contractions. And of course, from the point of view of psychological self-understanding and growth, you want to have the expansions and the contractions of consciousness under your own intention. And you want to, and those of you that are therapists or work in therapy, you know that a lot of work in therapy is, you know, freeing yourself from involuntary compulsions, addictions, like that. Okay. So if I press this. Okay, so these are two of my heroes, Albert Hofmann and Carl Jung. Jung was older, of course. He died in 55, I think?
61.
Albert Hofmann died in 2004 or 3. So, but they were both from Switzerland, one from Basel and one from Zurich. They didn't know each other, and I think they're two alchemists. And Switzerland is the home of the largest concentration of alchemy. Basel is the, you know, alchemical museum, and long tradition, centuries old tradition of alchemical experimentation. It's really interesting that their work was so interesting. But see, Jung did all these fantastic explorations of the unconscious layers of the psyche, and he wrote 4 of Jung's 20 volumes of collected works are about alchemy. They're alchemical texts. But he was not a chemist. Hofmann was a chemist who knew nothing about Jungian psychology. Nothing whatsoever. But in fact, he was not aware of his connection to the alchemical tradition until I talked with him about it. But he had a mystical vision when he was a child, when he was walking in the woods and as a 9-year-old boy, and he had this, he had several mystical visions, but he had this vision of all of nature and himself included was one vibrant whole, where he felt completely encompassed, safe, protected, in his core and in everything. And he had no language to describe this. He said to himself, he had this thought, and he only told this story much, much later, 50 years later, I'll never be able to describe this or paint it. I think I'll become a chemist. Because in the vision, it was nature. And chemistry, matter. It was matter. Nature, matter. And chemistry was the science of matter. And it was when he accidentally absorbed through his fingernips, through supposedly some sloppy lab technique, which in itself is a kind of an impossible story. Swiss chemists are probably the most obsessive compulsive people on the planet. I mean, they have to be. Think about it. Pharmaceutical chemist does not have sloppy lab techniques. It's just unheard of. But he apparently, because LSD is so fantastically potent, the amounts that can change your consciousness dramatically is invisible, basically. You can't see it. It's so minute, 100 micrograms. 100 micrograms is 100 millionths of a gram. It's a tiny, invisible speck. The only way you could see it is by putting it in something else. And but so he absorbed some. I don't know how, he said. And then he started having these incredible visions, and at first, kind of scary because he didn't know what was happening. Then when he went home and then he realized what was happening, this must have something. He didn't really know what was happening in his mind, you see, because he didn't realize that it was connected to a material substance until he remembered his childhood experience. Oh, it has to do with matter. The matter I was working with, which was in fact ergot, an ergot derivative, which is in fact where LSD comes from. So, so I'm going to say a little bit more about LSD, but now Jung, you see, they were Swiss, Jung had heard of psychedelic drugs, and he himself said, no, I don't want to take them. I mean, yeah, he said something like yes, because some of his followers had said, well, maybe this can give you access to the unconscious. And he said, well, I don't need to take it. I have enough access to my unconscious. In fact, I have just as much as I can handle, basically. Well, as you well know, and then some of you are reading the Red Book, and where he described his many years-long experimentation where he went into the unconscious himself and find a way to bridge from the unconscious back to his ordinary conscious life. Because that's the thing about psychedelic drugs. It's not just a matter of having an experience. Unless you can bridge the experience back into your ordinary life, then it's a waste, and it could in fact be dangerous. And at worst, it's a kind of, at the least, it's a kind of a distraction. For example, Charles Todd is a psychologist, and he interviewed a number of Buddhist meditation teachers in California. Studying Buddhism in the 60s, and he asked them what role psychedelics played in their practice originally and now. So these are Buddhist, long-term, 20-year-long Buddhist meditation practitioners and teachers. He said, well, psychedelic experiences, one or two I had, played a very significant role initially when I was first starting off, because they gave me an experience of what possible for consciousness to experience. But none now, because then I realized, well, okay, but I'm not going to be taking this drug all the time. So, then start doing the meditation, which otherwise the meditation is notorious for that, because you can, meditate for decades and never have any experience. In fact, that was one of Houston Smith, the scholar who wrote The Religions of Man. He wrote a book about which he discussed Christianity and Judaism and Islam and Buddhism and Hinduism. And the first time he took psychedelics, psilocybin or LSD, he said, oh, now I really understand the essence of the religions that I've been writing about as a scholar from the outside. So it's a mysterious thing, and that's that kind of experience that kind of inability to communicate something that seems very important to try to communicate is really at the core of the alchemical tradition. Because the alchemists are always saying exactly that. So, and so when you compare, Hoffman was an alchemist who focused on the material aspect. So matter and psyche and spirit, they're all on a continuum. They're not radically different. They're on a continuum, and they can be explored and are explored. And then the continuum of human beings is not like, it's not abnormal. Jung, of course, had the genius to expand the conceptions, the regular psychological theories of the unconscious, like Freud and others, and into these spiritual realms. But he didn't have any direct experience of except through his dreams, of the possibility of a substance inducing a mystical experience. His method was dreams. He didn't do alchemical experiments. In other words, he read books. All his alchemical writings are about interpretations of old alchemical books written in Latin and Greek, which he was a scholar of, and he wrote these books with enormous footnotes and absorbing and talking about the actual imagery and thought forms and ideas triggered by the associations in that tradition, and how that could relate to the personal psychological processes of a person. Like somebody would come in and say, well, I had this weird dream where, I saw this man, he had the head of a dragon and the body of a lion, and Jung would say, let me think. And he'd go to the bookcase and get out a book, and there would be a picture from a 17th century text of exactly that image. And that was very significant to the person. And he said, oh, okay, I'm not crazy. Somebody else had the same image, you see. That's the thing. If you have a weird, really weird image, you might wonder, am I crazy? Am I going nuts? But if you have one other person who can say, no, I had the same image, I saw the same thing, then that means that gives it a little bit more reality. Do you see that? That's why I have a formula in one of my books that says the subjective experience plus one equals objective. Subjective plus one equals objective. Then if you add plus two, three, four, then it becomes more objective. Objective is basically shared subjective experiences. You can be objective about your subjective experience. You can be objective about subjective experience, and that is, in fact, what I think the science of consciousness needs to be, and which is it's not at the moment, because at the moment, the science, so-called science of consciousness limits itself to the material, trying to explain consciousness away in terms of brain waves and molecular patterns, which is one level, yes. Doesn't explain consciousness, however. That's why they'll never explain consciousness that way, because consciousness is not something that you need to explain. So let me go on. So this is, and I'm going to come back to the book, The Expansion of Consciousness, in which I talk some more about the alchemical tradition and Jung, but let me just also go on and talk about alchemy a little bit. And in this book, this is kind of the book in which I explained the process that I called divination, which is a kind of a fusion of psychotherapy. I'm a trained psychotherapist, but I also, when psychotherapists, as you know, they primarily focus their attention on the past. And in recent years, a new profession has arisen called coaching, that helps people not so much to deal with, come to terms with their past, but to help to formulate and attain their goals and their aspirations in work, in family, in at every level, whatever, including spiritual. So divination to the past is essential to healing in therapy. For example, past divination in medicine is known as diagnosis. You diagnose an illness, you want to go, whether it's physical or psychological, when did I get that infection, when did I get that poison, that injury, that wound, that trauma, blah, blah, whatever it was, Oedipus complex, whatever it was, in your past. That's for the diagnostic part, but then you want the prognosis, in other words, how to heal it in the future. Now, if you're doing visioning is sort of the opposite of psychotherapy. It doesn't matter what the, you know, it's like, where am I going? Where am I going with my life? What am I going to do after I grow up? That's the child wants to know. The 5-year-old says, I want to be a pilot. And so he's got a vision. Well, people go on a vision quest. Go to the wilderness and fast. Vision quest. What's my vision for my life? Oh, great spirit, the Indians pray, sing songs. What's my vision for? That's not so much a job. I mean, you might have a vision for your job as well. I'm going to be a stockbroker. My vision is to make $1 million. That's a kind of a vision. We might not think it's very spiritual, and maybe it isn't, but still, it is a kind of a vision. It's a goal. It informs a goal. It informs your actions. It's future-oriented. And it's open-ended. Because you don't know whether you're going to get this. The one difference, you can access the past through memory, you can access the future through vision. The only difference is that the future is visioning is probabilistic. Not the past actually happened the way it happened, although you may have different interpretations of it. The future is probabilistic. So we all do that, visioning the future all the time. You have a vision, you're following a vision of your life, you know pretty well, you know, almost 100% certain, but not 100%, but 98%, 98%. You're still going to be, you know, in the near future, going to be living in the same house, married to the same person, with the same children, and the same job, and doing the similar kinds of things, pretty much, you know. Now, you may start to go through periods when things are in upheaval, and then you don't know. Where do I want to go? Why am I actually doing this? For what purpose? So then you're asking yourself vision questions. And you may go and do have a vision quest, or may you have a vision. Like the Indians would go and pray for a vision. But we might go to a consultant, or a family consultant and organizer, and dreams, you see. There was a big insight that occurred for me about 10, 15 years ago when I was teaching about this parallelism between vision and vision and the future and memory and healing in the past, that it's like vision and memory are like two sides of the same coin, so to speak. In fact, I use the image of the Roman deity Janus, the two-headed deity, as a symbol of that process. If you're going to be doing the workshop tomorrow, then we're going to be working with this Janus principle a lot. We're going to do some processes looking into the past because it's a double process. You go into the past, but not just to relive the past. That wouldn't be therapeutic, would it? Just to relive the past, you could do that endlessly and it never really makes any change. You want to integrate the past into your present life and what it means for you in your present life and your future. Because like in a traumatic memory, for example, is one that hasn't been integrated. So you go into it again in order to be able to make it part of your own self-history, your own self-concept, in order then to be free to go on with your life and not be driving your car or fixated in the rearview mirror and see what's coming behind you to overcome you. And the same with the future. If you have a future vision, well, it's not enough just to have it. You have to do something with it, because if you don't, then what is it? It's like a fantasy. The fantasy is not the same as actually doing something, you see. It's kind of a substitute. So you have a vision, and then you integrate that vision into your life. The little boy who has a vision, he's going to be a doctor. Well, then he has to, when he grows up, he has to go to school and go to medical school and, you know, start practicing. Realizing, that's called realizing the vision. And realizing is the is the counterpart for the future to remembering. That's why remembering is one of my favorite words in the English language, because in the past, remembering is reconnecting. It's the opposite of dismembering. So when you remember a traumatic memory that's been forgotten or split off, then you're reconnecting something from your past history that you've been disconnected from. So in the alchemical divination, accessing your spiritual intelligence, and you probably know, have heard the concept of the multiple intelligences. You know, people say mathematical, verbal, spatial, kinesthetic, all the different intelligences. Educators and others know in learning, I think there are about 6 or 7 different. Musical is another one. Almost like specific modules in the brain for these different kinds of intelligence, rather than just one IQ. You know, so. And I'm suggesting, along with some other people, that there's a kind of a spiritual intelligence, is the intelligence that that you develop to that includes the spiritual dimensions of life. And not, see, our mainstream sciences, including our mainstream psychology and social science, do not include the spiritual dimensions. And they haven't since the 17th century. That's part of the whole deal in the history of science. That was made between the church and the scientists. Because the church said, you can't deal with spirit, that's our department. You can only deal with matter. And the scientists said, well, okay then. You know, because they wanted to keep their jobs and they wanted to keep their heads. Because if you didn't agree with them, like Giordano Bruno, you know, he went to the stake. And Galileo said, knuckled under and said, you know, because he wanted to say, well, the planet's moving. I saw it through my telescope. He said, and the priest, the cardinal said, no, they're not moving. Otherwise, you know, St. Augustine would have said so, whatever. And he said, well, then, okay, if you're going to be that way about it. He muttered under his breath, "E pur si muove," but they moved. But he didn't let them hear that, you see. But they put him in jail, house arrest. You can start, keep looking through your stupid telescope and just don't say the planets move. Only 500 years later in this century, the church finally apologized to Galileo. Took him a long time to come around. It's kind of weird when you think about it, so that our whole scientific conception, see, has negated any mention. You can't write a scientific paper and get it published if you mention God or spirit or consciousness or psyche. What is that? What is that? Is that science? It's not science. That's dogma. It's dogma. Of course, there have always been exceptions. The greatest scientists have always been completely different. Albert Hofmann was one. Einstein himself was one. Einstein himself said, to me, the most significant thing is the sense of awe that we've had at the mystery, the unknown. Not the known. The known is not so interesting. The unknown is interesting because the unknown attracts us because we want to know what we don't know. Isaac Newton, the same thing, often regarded as the most intelligent scientist ever met. He said, you know, I may have discovered a few things, but, you know, I feel like I was like a little schoolboy who, down by the ocean, you know, found a few shiny pebbles that were kind of interesting, but beyond lay the vast boundlessness of the ocean, of which I knew nothing. That's the true humility of a true scientist, see. So, accessing your spiritual intelligence for healing and guidance. Healing always related to the past, guidance for the future. Okay. These are two alchemical mottos that are, I think, the key, or a key, to understanding the alchemical process. And I think of alchemy as, there are three traditional systems of transformation: shamanism, alchemy, and yoga. And they're systems of transformation at every level: physical, emotional, mental, spiritual. Spiritual and physical, emotional, mental. Shamanism, of course, the oldest, going back to the old Stone Age, involving the shamanic journey for healing and power, the way like people like Michael Horner, who's a good friend of mine, anthropologist, have brought the ancient shamanic traditions and condensing and distilling them, the essence of them, what's the core process, over and above the particular symbolic language used in this condition and that condition. It's a journey that you take to find knowledge, and you may have an animal that you ride with or move with on this journey, or some kind of vehicle. You identify with an animal, you fly like a bird, or you know, ride like a horse, or like that. In alchemy and yoga, I think of as the Eastern and Western kind of extensions of shamanic practices, because in shamanic they're also multi-level: spiritual, mental, emotional, physical. And you know, they're different. We know the different kinds of yoga: hatha yoga, bhakti yoga, jnana yoga, meditative. But it's always the spiritual dimension included. But in the West, you see, because of the peculiar religious history in the West, India didn't have that history with yoga. The Indian scientists don't have any problems in acknowledging that spirit is fundamental. In fact, that's what Indian science always say. But in the West, you couldn't say that because it's a cultural history. It's not true. It's not actually true. It's a self-imposed sort of lobotomy. Like, you're not going to look at certain parts of reality. In fact, the core of reality, which is the spiritual essence. Because that was the department of the church, even although the people practicing science don't even believe in the church anymore anyway. And have long stopped following the church's commands. Weird, isn't it? The alchemists then, you know, and alchemy, so in the 17th century, the alchemists had to stop doing, who wanted to continue practicing alchemy, had to stop doing so, or else, you know, get burned at the stake. And same with the shamans. And the shamans were the ones that were called as witches. You know, witches rode on a broomstick or whatever to find healing. They were the healers. Not only women, but men too. And the church said, no, you can't do that. That's, you know, we'll burn you at the stake. You know, it's pretty serious. So that, the tradition of... So alchemy split from chemistry. And chemistry is alchemy, except with all spirit and psyche out. Just matter. In the same way that astronomy is the same as astrology. It was originally one science, but astronomy is astrology with all the relationship of how the planetary movement relate to human consciousness and life on Earth, X'd out. Because the planets are just rocks out there zipping around. I don't know anything to do with the psyche or the spirit, even though the Greeks and all the others, you know, had been saying so. And Isaac Newton, the great chemist, was in fact an alchemist and did alchemical experiments for 30 years. But, you know, he had such a reputation and he wrote all his stuff in secret. See, that's where the alchemists disguised everything. They wrote it in a secret language so that only they amongst themselves could read their stuff. And the people from the Inquisition couldn't read it. They saw it was just nonsense. I now think that the so-called nonsense of the alchemical text was a deliberate disguise. It was a deliberate tactic so that, and including the reputation, because the church authorities would say, oh, these guys are, they call them the huffers and the puffers. They're just trying to make lead, you know, gold out of lead. They're just after the money. And that obviously can't be done. It's obviously stupid. It's impossible. And therefore, they're just greedy, stupid people like that. And the alchemists sort of accepted that reputation because it meant that people left them alone. Except for the people that actually knew and wanted to practice what they were practicing. And they didn't talk about it. They talked about it in a secret code. So they had to write these books. They couldn't publish in the scientific journals of the time. They had to write it in secret and pass it along in secret. And then, of course, in the course of time, many of them also would forget the language, and, you know, so a lot of the language is kind of garbled, but also not. as I think I'll be able to show you. So these two core alchemical mottos, one is natura naturans, is nature doing, being natural. Nature doing its natural thing. Nature being natural. And that's, you know, the core of a core healing tradition, stream. It's going back to Hippocrates, going back to Indian. The healer doesn't do anything. He just strengthens the body's, encourages, strengthens the body's own natural healing capacity, regenerative capacity. That's what the body does. Through nutrition, breathing, exercise, plants, massage, whatever. This natural means strengthening. The body has its own, the human being has its own natural healing, regenerative capacities. Just strengthen it, natural ways. That's a very honorable tradition that exists to this day. You know, various like herbal medicine, homeopathy. Homeopathy is a classic example of Indian medicine, Chinese medicine, acupuncture is the basic same idea. You know, just stimulate the meridians, stimulate the body's own natural healing energy. The body knows how to heal itself. Of course it does, otherwise it wouldn't be here. It wouldn't have evolved if it didn't know how to heal itself. It doesn't need interventions except in very few cases. If you have a broken bone, then you have to set the bone. Then the body heals itself. You put the bones back together and they'll grow together. But the alchemists also had another saying, and that's opus contra natura. Opus is the work. So opus is like the chemical term that corresponds to, in shamanism, the journey, the shamanic journey. The core process, the core method in alchemy is the opus, the work. So the work is consciously and intentionally working with the psychochemistry of your being, the multi-level chemistry of your being. And yes, the alchemists did take medicines, and they did make powders, but they also meditated, and they also consulted the planets, Paracelsus, you know, did astrology. Like Indian doctors to this day, they consult the horoscope of the patients. A lot of the shamans in Asia too, also they do combine shamanism with astrology, horoscopes. And so opus contra naturam, seemingly the opposite of natura naturans, nature doing naturally. So why opus? How could the opus be against? The way I interpret that would be that nature also our nature becomes habitual. We have habits, habits of thought, habits of the body, that become unconscious habits. Psychologists know this. And to develop the unconscious. See, in Eastern philosophy, now this is a big difference between Eastern and Western philosophies about consciousness. You know, we in the West we all assume, well, consciousness is sort of the base state. You know, like we're all conscious, so we have consciousness, we say, except when we're unconscious. And the Indian traditions, including Buddhism, Hinduism, all of them, say no, the default condition is unconsciousness. It's called avidya, not knowing, unconsciousness. And consciousness can only be developed through certain practices called yoga and meditation. Mindfulness. That's why you sit in meditation, mindfully thinking, not just unconsciously thinking. And you practice mindfulness. At first you practice it not doing anything, just sitting. That's sitting and observing your breath, mindfully breathing. And then you extend that to mindfully eating. And then you move up to, as you get better at it, mindfully, consciously thinking about things. Very difficult to do. So it's a very different way of thinking about it. So the opus, the way that I think of the opus is like in inertia. The inertia principle in psychology, in consciousness, means there's always a tendency to run down and lose consciousness. Not being attentive, not attending. Else how do things happen, right? How do accidents happen? How do we spill wine on our clothes? How do we crash into another car? How do we lose our temper? and start hitting somebody or yelling at somebody. Not conscious. We're slipping into unconscious. So opus contra naturam means like it's like the Sufis and people like Gurdjieff. Like you challenge your own unconscious tendencies and wake up, self-remember. Gurdjieff used to say self-remember, remembering who you are. Would you do the kind of, would we do the things that we afterwards regret if we were conscious? No, obviously not. That's why we have to say, I regret it. Sorry, I did that. I wasn't thinking. I'm sorry I did that. I wasn't thinking. I forgot myself, we say. We forget ourselves all the time. So that's the idea of the opus contra naturam. So both are true. Both are mottos that are appropriate. Okay. So here's one of these mysterious images, and the alchemist that appears in an alchemical book, I forget which one, 17th century probably, Body, Mind, and Spirit. But I think that's a cover. What I think, the way I interpret that image, I mean, body, mind, spirit, I think it's a disguise. So they put false labels on their images. This has to do with developmental psychology. This encourages you to look at the life cycle. It's a young man, a middle-aged man, and an old man. And this is similar to the very frequent images of the triple goddess. The goddess as a woman, as an old woman, as a crone, and as a young maiden. The goddess imagery, the triple goddess is much more widespread somehow. The triple god is much more rare. But it does appear, and this is an example of it. Except they don't call it that. They call it something about body, mind, and soul. But the alchemical images, the image itself speaks for itself, you see. And the people who knew, who had been trained and studying the tradition, would know how to interpret it and look at it as guidance for their thing. But it would be guidance. Look at the life cycle. And that's why in my book on alchemical divination, I have a whole chapter on looking at the life cycle. The stage of life that you're in, the kind of work that you do. We have these three, you can think of these three main stages. The youth stage, which is up to the Saturn return. Childhood, adolescence, up to the Saturn return, which is the late 20s, 28, 29. Planet Saturn, which is time, comes back to its original position. And then you have, that's the period of growth and development in your life. You're learning and growing, expanding consciousness and developing your capabilities and skills and interests, and gradually becoming more independent, building new relationships like that. Then 30s, 40s, and 50s, roughly, and this is very rough, of course, it's not always like that. Then you're like the mature age, you're a functioning adult, you often, people get married, have a family, start practice, finish medical school, finish law school, start practicing. Very different change. The Saturn return, in my workshop, I often ask people, maybe may do this tomorrow, to think about the Saturn return in their life, the period, 27, 28, 29. That's 3 or 4 or 5 year period, usually without exception, always without exception, I would say, the most fundamental turning point in everybody's life. In terms of where they live, who they live with, what they do, how they spend most of their time. Like that. And then the elder phase starts, it's the late 50s, you see the second Saturn return, 58, 59, so then the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and beyond, the elder period. That's, again, different from the middle period. Then maybe by that time your children are grown up or almost grown up, and maybe you retire. Traditionally, you might retire and go, become more spiritual, more interested, more. Maybe withdraw from some of the things. Of course, nowadays, people can start new jobs. And so, looking at the phase of life, that's what this alchemical image points to, I think. So, now we'll get into some of these very strange sayings of the alchemists. And one of the key things, of course, is what they call the stone, the lapis philosophorum, the stone of the wise. The stone of the philosophers. And if you look through the alchemical text, as I did in my book there, the Expansion of Consciousness, the first one, the first whole chapter is where I found a number of these the definitions where they try to define what the stone is. And it gets very, very strange. Our stone is found in all mountains, all trees, all herbs and animals, and all human beings. So right away you know it's not like a stone, like a rock in the usual way. But so what is it? It wears many different colors, contains the four elements, earth, water, fire, and air, which I relate to the material body substance of the human body, the water being the emotional, fire being the perceptual, nervous, visionary, and air being the mental. That's a pretty universal kind of symbolic connection. And man and has been designated a microcosm, so that's the old hermetic principle of the as above, so below. The human being is a microcosm of the greater universe, the universe within. Or this is from the 16th century, the glory of the world. They always give these alchemical texts these incredibly effusive names, you see. Something very precious. This stone is under you, near you, above you, and around you. So it's clearly not the case. You can't just say, well, it's a certain kind of stone or substance, or even as some of my friends and colleagues in the so-called psychedelic movement seem to think it's, well, it's LSD, obviously. The stone is LSD. Well, I'm sorry, but, you know, it's not. LSD is a crystallized substance, yes. It is a crystallized substance. But this stone can be under you, near you, above you, and around you. Found in all herbs and animals, and in human beings. So I'm just going to leave these there for you to think about. And questions, ask yourself what it means, what it might mean. I like the phrase, ask yourself or ask myself. Because when you say, I ask myself, you realize that you assume, you think, you believe that there is a part of you that knows more than you do. Right? Otherwise, why would you be asking yourself? You're asking somebody who knows more than you do. You're asking your higher self, as we might say. It's like, or the ego is asking the self. And when you ask, you make yourself receptive. That's why I think questions are more interesting than answers. Because when you have the answer, then it's like you close the book. You know, you finish the research project, you close the book. Oh, okay, now I know that now, put it in the shelf. If you ask a question, then you are still searching. That's the whole thing about Zen, right? The Zen guy says, go, you know, meditate. What's the sound of one hand clapping? The guy comes back and says, well, it's so-and-so, and Zen master gives him a whack, says, oh, that's not it, go meditate some more. Every time, every answer he gives, that's not the answer, because there is no answer. The point is to ask the question. So questions open you up, keep you searching. Okay. Hermes Trismegistos. Now this Hermes the god. Hermes the Trismegistos is this kind of legendary, semi-legendary figure, a high-level initiate. He lived, who knows, Egypt. Nobody knows exactly when. Maybe second, around the turn of the millennia, third, fourth century, before, after. Nobody knows exactly. Obviously, a whole school. He initiated a school. It's a school of the Hermetic tradition, which is also the alchemical, is the Hermetic tradition. And it's a secret tradition. It's an underground tradition. You don't talk about it. The reason you don't talk about it is not because you want to, you know, you love secrets per se, or is because it wouldn't be understood, which is in fact the case. It wouldn't be understood unless you go through the processes that would help you to understand it, you see. Because it involves practices, like yogic practices, you don't really understand it. It's like, you know, chemists talking to one another, but it's hermetic because if you're not a chemist, you don't understand it, the language. You don't know what they're talking about, what the experiences are, what the observations are that they've made. But Hermes says, the sun is the father, the moon the mother, the wind bears it in its womb, and is nursed by the earth. So of the four elements, fire and air are male, masculine, by the alchemist, polarized, and water and earth, feminine, because fire and air rise up, water and earth sink down. In psychological, you say in terms of the four functions, I would say air and fire corresponds to thinking and intuition, and water and earth to feeling and sensing. Alchemical texts are filled with multiple illustrations of the four elements and various combinations. So the sun is the father, the moon the mother, the basic polarity, which also is the right-left polarity. If you look at alchemical drawings, of which there'll be one next, you'll see the male is always, it's the right side of the body also. That's the same as in yoga. I see Ida and Pingala. Yoga on the right side is Pingala, the sympathetic nerve system, the right-left side, the parasympathetic moon, feminine, Pingala side. So, and then the conjunctio, see, is the integration of the fire and the sun. Fire and water. The wind bears it in his womb. Why, that's a strange image. First of all, the wind is male. Wind has a womb. And the way I interpret that, in fact, there's another image of it. But nursed by the earth, let me go on. Okay, so the next one is this one. This is an image of from a series of images illustrating the conjunctio. The conjunctio is Jung wrote a 700-page book on the Mysterium Conjunctionis. It's a kind of a core integrative alchemical process. It has many stages and many aspects, a series of images in alchemical books showing different stages of the conjunctio. It's not just a one-shot deal. Integrating of the male, female, sun, moon, masculine, feminine images, solar, lunar in the body. So here you have the male standing on the sun, on the right, you're looking at it, it's on the left, but think of this as a picture of a human being. See, this is inside a person, this is not two people, this is one person. So on your right side, that's the solar side, your left side is the lunar side. And she's standing on the moon, he's standing on the sun, and then they're giving each other their left hand. So they're making a first awkward gauche. You know, the term gauche means left contact. They're getting acquainted, the male-female side of you. That's the first stage. And they have these staff with flowers, and then there's a bird with a star coming from above, inspiring their getting together. Does that make sense to you? So, now, the wind has carried in his belly, see? He's got a fetus in his belly. Why? Because wind, air, is masculine, so that seems paradoxical. But air is mind. The process of transformation, every process of transformation or healing, has to start in the mind. You have to have the idea first. You have the idea. Otherwise, think about the word conception or concept means idea. And it also means conception. Right? And prior to birth, there has to be a conception. Where the male seed and the female seed come together, called conception, and takes root. If you want to do anything, even self-transform yourself, become enlightened, you first have to have the idea that you want to be enlightened. This is not going to happen accidentally or sort of by the way. Obviously. It's like the intention in the mind. So that's how I would interpret that image. The wind has carried it in its belly, and its nurse is the earth. You have the idea, but then you have to nourish the idea of transformation, in this case, the idea of transformation or enlightenment. You have to nourish it, feed it, protect it. It's not going to happen by itself. You can have the idea and never do it, then the idea just goes flying off like some other idea. And she's Mother Earth, you see. The earth, the mother is always the earth, and the earth is always the mother. All life arises from the earth. Okay, so our substance is openly displayed before the eyes of all, yet it is not known. So obviously it's not a particular object. Two people could be looking at the same thing and one is seeing it, the stone, and the other is not. It has to do something with your perception, with how you look at things. Learned doctors have it before their eyes every day, but they do not understand it because they never attend to it. I like the titles of these, but it's a 17th century text, The New Chemical Light. Right? This is when alchemy and chemistry were still one substance, looking at it from the point of view of chemistry. So of course, in every psychological process, the way we would say it nowadays, of course, every single psychological process, every thought, every feeling, every perception, there's chemistry going on. Of course. And there's whole sciences and neuropsychochemistry and, you know, studying it in detail. But they study it only with the external methods. They don't study it in themselves. And that's what the Hermeticists did. They studied it in themselves. And they regarded their own body, their own multi-level psycho-cosmic organism as the laboratory in which you do the work that you're doing, that you're learning. And of course, you also do it out there, and you have potions that you take and drink and powders and da-da-da, and apply in your healing with animals and people and da-da-da. But the laboratory is, the opus is done inside. The healer, it's the same principle as the healer, heal thyself, right? Heal thyself. If you can't heal somebody else of a liver disease if you've got a liver disease yourself, obviously. First heal the liver yourself, you see. Then you'll be able to, then you would go to the doctor that knows how to heal it. Obviously, he's known how to heal it. Okay, so I've done that one. Do the next one. Okay, that's another stage of the conjunctio. So here they are already, the two sides of you, then they're sitting in the vessel. This is the vessel. It's like a hot tub, except it's not a Mill Valley hot tub where you're sitting with your partner. It's the hot tub of your body. The vessel is the body. Actually, I would say the body and energy field. Because the physical, the subtle energy body field, which extends 10, 15, 20, 50 feet out in every direction, is as much part of your vessel as the physical body. So they're sitting in water, and the water, the hot water, is melting the differences between them, is melting the separation between them. They've taken their clothes off, which means they're no longer covering. The cover, this is what the yogic traditions call coverings. I forget what the name they have. Kleshas, obstructions, blockages, or Reichian bodywork, muscle tensions, armoring, that prevents different parts of your body from, you know, because the muscles are tight from the energy freely flowing between the two sides and between all the different parts of the organ. So you're sitting in a hot tub using the warmth and the heat of the solutio, what the alchemists call this process, the solutio, which means dissolving the tensions. In order to allow these two core energetic male, female, yin-yang, sun, moon, parts of your being come closer together. And notice here, it's the right hand of one to the left hand of the other, left hand of one receiving the right hand from the other. See, this is a much closer conjunction of the two. And now, this thing, the stone, is extracted from you. So that shows very clearly, it's something in you. Something physical, psychophysical, cellular, who knows. You are its ore, like a precious metal extracted, has to be, like gold has to be extracted from the ore, not until it is. When you have experienced this, the love and desire for it will be increased in you. And I love this one too, 18th century, Gerard Dorn. We cannot be resolved of any doubt except by experiment. See, these people were real true scientists. Don't take it for granted. It's not a matter of belief. Test it out yourself. See for yourself. Practice it. The point of yoga is not to put forth some theory. Same with shamanism. Test it. Apply it. Use it. And there's no better way to make it on ourselves. Healer, heal thyself. Okay. Then, so here's another stage of the conjunction. So here, the legs, the torso, the upper, lower torso, upper torso, are already conjoined into one. But the heads, the organism still has two heads. Because that's the hardest part. Because the brain is so complicated. Integrating the two brain hemispheres is very difficult. It takes a long time. Much easier to integrate the heart and the liver and the stomach and the different, other parts of the organism relatively can be harmonious. But harmonizing the two brain hemispheres is very difficult because it's so complex. It takes a long time. So there's an intermediate stage, the two-headed being. You could make some weird Hollywood movie about that. They do make weird Hollywood movies about it all the time. Okay, it is called perfect. Perfect means complete. Perfected means complete. Because it has in itself the nature of mineral, vegetable, and animal. For the soul is triple and one, having four natures. So that shows right there, see. It's not just a human psychological process. When the pure and essential elements are joined together in a loving equilibrium, as they are in our stone, they are inseparable and immortal, like the human body in paradise. See, you can see all kinds of questions that arise. Oh, we have a human body in paradise? Obviously, yours has to be like your human body in paradise, not somebody else's. Okay, and this is another beautiful image of the conjunctio, as the image of the marriage of fire and water. See, this makes it very clear you're not talking about anatomy. You're talking about energies. So the fiery on the right, fire and water, and the watery on the left, they're conjoining, the arms are conjoining, they're not really arms, they're not human arms, it's not a human form, just the face and head, enough indicated so that you can see, this is in us. Maybe you could say this is an image of the modern physiologist might say this is a sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. We have these two parallel autonomic nervous systems. One is more energetic, daytime sympathetic, doing and acting and fiery. The parasympathetic is more feminine, relaxing, nighttime, that kind of thing. The most ancient secret, natural, incomprehensible, heavenly, blessed, beatified, and triune, universal, stage, stone of the sages. This is reminiscent, I don't know if you've ever read some of these Buddhist texts or Hindu texts when they start talking about different stages of enlightenment, or they just go on after on, phrase after phrase of in praise of these realms of being and realms of consciousness that can be attained through these practices. And then I love this term, the Sophic hydrolith. Hydrolith means water stone. water, like hydro and lith, stone. And sophic, again, is wisdom, the water stone of wisdom. And that shows a stone, you know, so again, it's paradoxical. It's not just a rock. It's not just a rock. It's a water stone. So it's solid like stone, but flows like water. So what is like that? There is a consciousness like that. It's a state of consciousness. This is one of my teachers said, I asked him, you know, what is it? He said, the philosopher's stone is not a magical object. It is the magnificent condition resulting from reaching objectivity, the ability to be objective about fact, to know and perceive the hard fact, stone, like, of a given situation as it actually is, without illusion and distortion. Another analogy would be like in the Eastern Buddhist tradition, they talk about Vajra consciousness. And Vajra is both diamond and lightning. You know, diamond, the hardest substance known, stone and all that, the hardest substance known, and lightning, the most brilliant, bright light. Here's a modern painting by somebody showing the conjunction of fire and water, but both female. See, the way different ways of doing the conjunction is not always necessarily the same. Because males and females can be fiery and watery, and so can males, and you know. This is a Janus, the Roman coin. The Roman used the imagery of Janus looking in the two directions as the imagery of I interpret that as being, it was the coin of the realm. And Janus was the gatekeeper of the dog, of the gods, who sat at heaven's gate and paid attention to who was coming and going, the gods and goddesses in their various excursions. Janus always knew. And it's the month of January, it's the root for January, you know, the month of January, the winter solstice. And the turning point of the year is also the root for janitor. The gatekeeper, the doorkeeper, he sees you where you're going. And it's a coin of the realm. You pay to cross the border, pay the customs man, pay the border crossing, pay admission, pay the price. This is just another chemical image showing the threefold division of, like in this case, a threefold division of the body energy field. Usually having, like in Taoism, you have, you know, the way I think of it, it's the head, upper throat head is one thing, more thinking awareness. The middle part is more like heart, abdomen, heart awareness, feeling awareness. Lower part, abdomen, pelvic, more like sensory body kind of awareness. And the alchemists have those kind of triple images, very, very widespread all over, including all the Buddhist stupas, you know, with the cube and then the sphere, and then the triangle. Anyway, and this is from my book, The Alchemical Divination. So this is the way I work with the traditional chakras in the middle. But like the Taoists, I talk about three chambers: upper chamber, middle chamber, cave of the heart, little cauldron, pelvic abdominal area. And then there are centers in the legs. There's not just seven chakras. I mean, there's, you know, 11 or 13 chakras, depending. And there's chakras above the head and below the feet. But this is the idea. And the energies in each of these main chambers is slightly different. Then you work with them all, balancing them, refining them like that. And this is a chemical image. This is just a kind of mysterious image, just to give you an example of, I forget actually which text it was, some text from the 17th century. They talk about, they have these four balls of fire standing in a landscape, and it says, the only text is, a fourfold fireball controls this work. Okay, here's how I interpret that. That's the text. Atalanta Fugiens, 1618, 17th century, early 17th century. This four balls of fire is a yogic process. working with fire in four main segments of the body. The three main segments that we just saw, the abdomen, pelvis, the middle abdomen, the middle chest area, the throat and head, and then one above the head. So it's an alchemical emblem describing a yogic process. But see, this is how the alchemists, alchemical practitioners would pass their yoga. They couldn't actually describe it as an actual practice, because then the church would be down there breathing down their neck and busting them and putting them in jail or burning them at the stake. So they just made it symbolic. It's just a symbolic picture, you know, you figure it out. And what gave me the key, what finally confirmed for me the key, is the outhouse. See the outhouse next to the lowest sphere? It's the pelvic. That's like a little key that's built in. And this is another one. You've probably seen this. The serpent devours its own tail. And the serpent is an energy, the serpentine. Kundalini is called a serpent. It's kind of the energy that goes around this, goes up. You know, the kundalini is supposed to go up the spine from the root chakra to the crown chakra. But in the Taoist tradition, they have a completely different tradition. They have, yes, there's an energy that goes up, and then it goes up the back and comes over the top and goes down the front. That's what they call it, up the back, over the top, comes down the front. There's a meridian that comes down here from the nose and goes down to the pelvic, and then there's another meridian that goes up the back over the top of the head, and they both meet there, as you can see here. In the upper image here, the Ouroboros image. The governor vessel Yang is goes up. The energy goes up the back, and the Yin conception vessel goes up the front. And they meet at this point, the point of consciousness, above the upper lip, point 28. This is where it. I had a revelation because I had a friend of mine and we were talking about this work, and she's an acupuncturist, and she pointed out that this point where the two channels meet, the Yang governor vessel up the back, called associated with heaven, and the Yin governor vessel, conception vessel going up the front, meet at that point. And that's the point called the point of consciousness. You stimulate that point in acupuncture when somebody's unconscious or drunk. Or in a coma. Interesting, isn't it? That's exactly the point. So I think the image, and that's the image of the serpent with its own tail in its mouth. In fact, you could try that yourself. Touch this point right now. You know, it's a kind of additional, let me see. Right? Let me see, or let me think. Makes the connection between heaven and earth, the yang and the yin. Let me remember. See, in the book, The Alchemical Divination, I have some examples of how this is used. And it's used to revive people if somebody's gone unconscious or drunk. Like first aid. Might be useful to remember sometime. Okay, I'm just about finished. I think I should finish pretty soon. And so these are four statements that are sort of summarize the basic principles of the work that I call alchemical divination. And it has to do with memory, as I mentioned, you know, memory going into the past, but integrating it, bringing it back to the present. So intentional memory with conscious integration is remembering and leads to healing and increased wholeness. Unconscious memory, like without integration, is flashback, regression. You know, somebody's suddenly back in their childhood trauma and acting from that. And leads to hopelessness or useless nostalgia. You just say, oh, you think about the good old days when I was happy and didn't have to worry about a thing. My parents took care of me, whatever. Intentional vision with conscious integration is inspiration. Inspiration means spirit coming in and leads to realization and creative expression. In creative expression, you make the vision real. Unconscious vision without integration is fantasy and leads to loss of faith and pointless distractions. Now, unless, I mean, you, not to say that fantasy is bad, you know, if you have a fantasy and then you write a book about it, like, what's that book series called? Harry Potter, you know, and become a millionaire and write dozens of books and inspires people and gives great stories. Absolutely. That's a way of realizing that vision. Or compose music or paint it, and so that's completely different. But if you just think about it, someday I'll do that, and it leads to loss of faith and pointless distraction. People don't know, what am I doing with my life? I'll go to this thing and go to that thing, like that. So that's the idea. So with that, I thank you for your attention. And